The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the Stomach is presented by Dr. Jack Bragg.
My charge for the next 30 minutes is to get through diseases of the stomach. Kind of like doing world history in 30 minutes. So most of these things I'm going to cover, these next few slides just tell you the topics that I'm going to hit on for the next 30 minutes, and won't be a lot of detail on any of them, but like Lindsay just said, I'm always happy to answer questions afterwards if anybody has anything that they want to go into on any depth on any of these things. All right, gastric and intestinal motility disorders. These can be classified, remember, as neuropathic or myopathic. You can see the potential causes right there. The one we're going to concentrate on just a little bit is the diabetic gastroenteropathy. As you probably recall, diabetes affects the entire GI tract. It affects almost the entire human body, but especially the GI tract and the cardiovascular system. Involved in a gut that's affected by diabetes usually is delayed gastric emptying over a period of time. We used to say you had to have type 1 diabetes for 10 years before you could have gastroparesis or some kind of motility disorder, but we don't say that anymore because, well, basically, it's not true. You can see somebody that's got gastroparesis after a couple of years of diabetes or less than 10 years. So the 10-year thing is not true anymore. What you also may see is a short period of accelerated gastric emptying prior to the onset of the gastroparesis. Now, you look at these symptoms here for accelerated and delayed gastric emptying, and there's a lot of crossover. So it's hard to make a diagnosis clinically, accelerated versus delayed gastric emptying. You have to have some studies of some sort to be able to make a diagnosis. And usually that's going to be a solid phase gastric emptying study, a nuclear study. Diabetes, as I mentioned earlier, affects the entire GI tract. We'll talk a little bit about a couple of these, but concentrate on the gastroparesis, with which you get nausea, vomiting, postprandial fullness, and abdominal pain. Well, that doesn't narrow it down very much because there's a lot of GI disease that present with those particular types of symptoms. So it takes a little bit of history to be able to get to the diagnosis. It's very common. 50% of long-standing type 1 diabetes patients have delayed gastric emptying. It's most prevalent in type 1, but can also occur in your type 2 patients, your older patients. Usually, in other words, 50 to 70% of the time, it's associated with an autonomic neuropathy. We used to think that was the only cause. We don't think that anymore. There's probably more to it than that, but no firm conclusions about other contributions besides the autonomic neuropathy. High blood sugar levels exacerbate the problem, and the consequences may include delayed gastric emptying, rapid emptying of liquids early on, as I mentioned before, Bezoar formation, poor blood sugar control, and malnutrition or weight loss if it's significant enough to cause that kind of trouble. Rapid gastric emptying, here's the definition of rapid gastric emptying. When more than 30% of the meal that they swallow leaves the stomach within 30 minutes or more than 70% at 60 minutes. Now, you can have rapid gastric emptying for other reasons, as you can see there, besides early diabetic gastroparesis. These aren't real common. Idiopathic early diabetes, ZE syndrome, which is usually a once in a career type of thing, but I would, and I'm going to talk some more about ZE, but I would concentrate on it if I were taking the boards, because you know how the boards are. They don't consist of the common and the ordinary. They consist of the once in a career type of disease, and Zollinger-Ellison syndrome is one of those. Surgeries can also lead to that. here's another item that can be confusing when it comes to the pathology of GI disease, and that's the nomenclature of the pathology that the pathologist is looking at. There are a myriad of terms. These are probably the easiest to remember and probably give you the most information. Gastropathy is literally any gastric lesion. It's used as a substitute for gastritis when there's no inflammation or when inflammation is absent or minimal. There are other cells that you will see. Obviously, this doesn't include malignancy and that type of thing, but gastritis includes leukocyte infiltration in the stomach. You can have active or acute. Usually the pathologist is going to report a lot of neutrophils under those circumstances. Chronic gastritis is mononuclear leukocytes, and you can have chronic active gastritis, mixed chronic and active inflammation. Now, these are two types of atrophic gastritis that I would remember for the boards. Type A or autoimmune, type B environmental. You can see on the left-hand side of the slide the problems that are associated with type A and type B. You might very well have a question of an individual who has a macrocytic anemia, and they have an EGD that shows atrophic gastritis. Which of these are you likely to be dealing with? The answer, of course, would be type A. Macrocytic anemia speaks of the possibility of pernicious anemia, B12 or folate deficiency, that type of thing. This is a cartoon of what it looks like endoscopically. Autoimmune or type A usually involves the body of the stomach, whereas type B or environmental involves usually the antrum, and it can advance from the antrum into the body of the stomach. Granulomas and gastritis, another rare oddity that could easily turn up on the boards. Systemic diseases associated with granulomatous gastritis include, as you can see there, Crohn's, which is probably the most common of these three entities, Crohn's, sarcoid, and Wegener's. Crohn's disease, the granulomatous gastritis occurs 1-2% of the time, so it's not common, but it's more common than those other two. Diseases where the granulomas are isolated to the stomach include idiopathic granulomatous gastritis, foreign objects, things like toothpicks, partial plates, those type of things that end up in the stomach and don't move, and tumor-associated types of diseases like malt lymphoma. Infections such as H. pylori, TB, tertiary syphilis, Whipple's disease, and histo may cause a type of granulomatous gastritis as well. Large gastric folds. Here's another area that is chaotic and it's confusing in the literature because there are different names for different ones of these. Gastrin-stimulated Ruggle hypertrophy. Remember, hypertrophy means an enlarged organ. Hyperplasia means an increased number of cells. Gastric-stimulated Ruggle hypertrophy, ZE, and occasionally a DU patient will show that. Hypertrophic hypersecretory gastropathy. You can have non-gastrin-stimulated or protein-losing gastropathy. Menetrier disease has, I think I've got a picture of the large gastric folds go along with that. And some miscellaneous causes that you note down there. Yeah, this is Menetrier's disease on the right, Zollinger-Ellison on the left. This is what the pathology specimen looks like. For both of these diseases, the treatment used to be stomachectomy. Take out the stomach, you stop the acid producing, and you relieve the patient of their disease. You also relieve them of being able to eat very well and digest. But this is what it looks like grossly. Non-ulcer dyspepsia. Non-ulcer dyspepsia is probably affected by H. pylori. The frequency, though, in NUD is about the same as the asymptomatic population. So H. pylori is not the only factor involved here. We don't really know what the others are. Prospective clinical trials of anti-H. pylori therapy generally have had disappointing results. There was I think the ACG published it a few years ago. They said, anybody with non-ulcer dyspepsia, treat them for H. pylori infection, and some of them will get better. And some of them did, but a lot of them didn't either. As yet, we've been unable to identify a subpopulation that does get better with treatment that achieve a long-term symptomatic benefit from H. pylori therapy. So it's basically symptomatic treatment at this point for NUD, anticholinergics and that type of thing. Causes of peptic ulcer, Helicobacter, nonsteroidals, and I'd remember these rare causes that you see here. Hypersecretory states like ZE, Menetrier's disease, herpes simplex, Crohn's disease, and systemic mastocytosis, which I've never seen a case of in 30 years, so that would make a good board question too. But everybody's familiar with H. pylori and nonsteroidals. There's something else involved with this because we're seeing a lot of peptic ulcer disease these days in people who are not taking nonsteroidals and who don't have H. pylori infection. What that cause may be, nobody seems to know yet. Here's some other non-acid or non-peptic disorders that may cause peptic ulcer disease. Some of these you may be familiar with and some you may not. Lindsay talked about the pill-induced esophagitis. You can get pill-induced peptic ulcer disease too from things besides nonsteroidals. You see there tetracycline, which isn't used much anymore, potassium chloride, and some others. You see the usual list of suspects as far as diseases go, CMV, and some malignancies on the right side of the screen there. On this list that you're seeing here, probably Crohn's disease is the most common one to cause ulcers. You may see a duodenal cap ulcer. You can see problems in the antrum of the stomach from Crohn's disease. Again, it's unusual, but it does occur, probably the most common on this list. These are x-rays, endoscopic views in the center, and histology on the right of what gastric cancers may look like. I'll talk a little more about gastric cancer in the oncology lecture, but thing to remember about gastric cancers is they are, any gastric ulcer that you see is cancer until you prove that it's not. And the way you do that is biopsy the heck out of every ulcer and then re-scope them in 6-8 weeks, whatever you think's right, and make sure that ulcer's healed up, because early gastric cancer oftentimes looks exactly like peptic ulcer disease. So it has to be rechecked until it's gone. Only then can you be sure that it wasn't an ulcer disease. Now, other than the histology, looking at any of these x-rays or endoscopic views, you would not know if that's an ulcer or a cancer. That's why you have to reevaluate it. H. pylori, this is a microscopic view of the flagellated organism. It's gram negative, it's a spiral rod, it's fastidious, microaerophilic, urease positive, and unipolar flagella, its characteristics. The pathophysiology we think is that this organism is ingested orally. It swims, if you will, through the mucus, attaches to the mucosa, and begins to multiply, damages tissue by elaborating urease. To the best of our knowledge, nobody ever gets H. pylori sepsis. It doesn't penetrate beyond the mucosa, at least that any of us know about. It sticks pretty much to the mucosa of the stomach. What happens with H. pylori if it's not treated? You can see by this slide the various potential outcomes: acute infection, acute gastritis, chronic active gastritis, and then it can be asymptomatic, it can cause peptic ulcer disease, environmental atrophic gastritis, that's what EMAG is, gastric carcinoma, or a MALT lymphoma. Those are all potential results of chronic ongoing H. pylori infection. How do you diagnose it? Well, there's some non-invasive methods, antibody tests. Gastroenterologists don't recommend them, and it's not just because we don't get to do a procedure. But an antibody test just tells you that somebody at one time or another has had an H. pylori infection. It doesn't tell you much about whether it's ongoing or not, so it doesn't have a lot of utility, we don't think. Urea breath tests are excellent. There's two types of them. Stool antigens we probably use more than anything else to check for eradication. If somebody has been treated for H. pylori and they are off their PPI, they don't need it anymore, they have to be off for a couple of weeks, We'll check a stool antigen because it's inexpensive. The sensitivity and specificity of it is excellent, and it's the best way to check for eradication. You can rescope them and rebiopsy them if you want to, but it's not necessary to check for eradication. Already talked about that. Two types of urea breath test. One is non-radioactive and one is radioactive. You just have to see what your particular nuclear medicine department does. World Health Organization has concluded that there is sufficient evidence to make H. pylori a carcinogen. It's a group one or a definite carcinogen. And you recall the slide I showed a while ago, it can either cause malt lymphoma or adenocarcinoma of the stomach. This is malt lymphoma. I do see one of these on occasion. They aren't real common or real usual, but you will find one every once in a while. Malt-associated lymphoid tissue, it's a benign reactive process consisting of lymphoid follicles. It becomes a lymphoma when you get a monoclonal proliferation of neoplastic B lymphocytes infiltrating the gastric glands. And I don't read pathology slides. They could put anything up there and I'd have to believe it. But this is supposedly what it looks like once it becomes a lymphoma. Presentation can be across the board, anything. It can be asymptomatic. Patient can have dyspepsia, weight loss, ulcers. Endoscopically, the mucosa can appear normal. You can have thickened folds like any lymphoma, or you can have ulcerations. Usually this is a disease of older folks. The last patient I saw, though, I think was only in his 40s. So it can happen to about anybody, but generally, like many cancers, it occurs mostly in the older population. If you have a patient with malt lymphoma, remember that curing the H. pylori results in remission in approximately 75% of all patients. Regression usually occurs within 6 months, but it may take longer than that. So don't give up until the 6-month mark is passed, at least. There are no features that predict unresponsiveness, and the recurrence of the malt lymphoma is associated with reinfection. Most of these people are going to be involved with an oncologist, and so you'll have them to assist you in the treatment of this. There are several approved combinations of therapy for H. pylori. You all probably know them as well as I do. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. They've gotten now into advanced treatment strategies like salvage type of therapy. This is for the H. pylori that is resistant to these drugs or some of the others. And there's several different layers of treatment now that I doubt that you'd be asked about that on an examination. Who knows, you could be. But this is what you're seeing right here is probably the most commonly used treatment regimen for patients with H. pylori. Some people recommend 10 days, some recommend 14 days. I usually do it 14 days just to make sure more than anything else. When you've got more than one drug like this, oftentimes it's not tolerated well. People may take it a couple of days, then stop it if it makes their symptoms worse. And so the other treatment regimen besides this one that's oftentimes used is a bismuth-based regimen, where you don't have the same combination of drugs. You still have antibiotics, but bismuth is tolerated better sometimes than some of the other drugs. This is a slide that we used to, this was the center of the lecture on peptic ulcer disease, because on the left, you can see you've got the receptors on the parietal cell, and we talked about blocking each one of these and how much good it did and how much good it didn't do. And that's H2 blockers, that's the way they work. They block the histamine receptor, and they shut down acid production about 75%, your cimetidines and ranitidines and those over-the-counter drugs. PPIs work differently. They destroy this pump here that you see in the middle of the slide, the potassium hydrogen pump, and they shut down acid production closer to 90%. So the PPIs are much more potent medications than the H2 blockers. There's some strategies that we'll recommend, especially for reflux disease, using an H2 blocker at night along with a PPI. You don't see that with peptic ulcer disease. It's usually not necessary, but reflux is harder to treat. I'm not convinced that works very well. It makes the patient think you're doing something in addition for them, and it may help some people, but tachyphylaxis is too much of a problem with H2 blockers, I think, for it to be a very effective strategy. Nonsteroidal ulcers, key here is history. Duh, they have to have been taking either a nonsteroidal or aspirin. Daily aspirin will cause peptic ulcer disease. Location is usually on the greater curve. They tend to have more gastric ulcers than duodenal ulcers, but DUs are possible. And you well know they can present with either GI bleeding, pain, vomiting, any number of type of symptoms. If the ulcer is located close to the pylorus, they can present with a gastric outlet obstruction. That usually involves vomiting and pain. Clinical course, they can be difficult to heal because you always ask yourself, do I continue the nonsteroidal or do I have to stop it? There's all kinds of thought on this about what the right thing to do is. It basically boils down to, does your patient have to have the nonsteroidal? If they can't walk without the nonsteroidal, you can try and treat through it with the anti-ulcer medication, the PPI. Doesn't do any good clinically to add carafate to that. There's no advantage. The other thing you can consider is the possibility of using, can't think of the name of the drug, it inhibits. I'll think of it tomorrow when I'm not here anymore. But at any rate, you have to decide. What you can do is treat the ulcer disease and use something like Tylenol or Tylenol with codeine to control the musculoskeletal pain if you have to. Neither one of those strategies are great. Nobody wants to keep somebody on a nonsteroidal if they've got an active ulcer. Nobody wants to start narcotics if they don't have to. So you're kind of between a rock and a hard place. Peptic ulcer, therapeutic endoscopy. 80% of the time we can control the GI bleeding. You might be given a scenario of a 84-year-old gentleman in ICU who has a multitude of comorbidities. He has to be anticoagulated because of coronary artery disease, and he's got a bleeding peptic ulcer. What do you recommend? With endoscopic therapy, most of the time, as you can see, 80%, we can stop the bleeding and it stays stopped. In a patient like that, it may not, regardless of how you treat it, whether you use epinephrine injection, a gold probe, clipping, whatever you do, you may be successful or you may not. So you have to talk to the cardiologist. Can you stop the anticoagulant? We had a patient like this at the VA 2 weeks ago. Asked a cardiologist if they could stop the Agrinox. He said, no, can't do it under any circumstances. So we had to treat through the anticoagulation, do the best we could endoscopically. And last time I checked, the patient was doing well, but it's possible that they won't if they have to continue with the anticoagulation. But once you've tried endoscopic therapy, a time or two or even three, this gentleman I was talking about had an ejection fraction, I think, of 7, something like that. So he was very fragile. He wasn't going to tolerate just a whole lot. But you can get IR involved in interventional radiology and see if they can do something through catheterization, identify the artery and treat it that way. Or if the patient's a surgical candidate, they can go to surgery. Haven't done that very often in the last few years, but it's still a solution once in a while. Upper GI bleeding, these are the things that cause people not to get better. If they start out in shock, if they're vomiting bright red blood, varices or gastric cancer, those folks don't do so well most of the time. Comorbid disease, like I just mentioned, older age, onset of bleeding in the hospital, or recurrent bleeding, those are all bad prognostic signs. This is basically the same thing. This tells you the percentages of people who aren't going to do well depending on the diagnosis. And you see on the far right there, no diagnosis. And you may ask, well, how can that be? If somebody throws up blood, they've got to have a diagnosis, right? Well, most of the time they do. But if the time between when they come into the hospital with their bleeding and the time you scope them, if that's more than a few hours, it does happen periodically that you don't find anything. is that a Dieulafoy's lesion or something else going on? You know, it's hard to tell. We don't know, but we do scope people once in a while that have thrown up blood, and we don't find anything. So the sooner you scope them, the more likely you are to find a lesion. And having done this for a long, long time, I know it's more fun to scope somebody at 8 a.m. than it is 2 a.m. But when you delay the endoscopy, that's one of the risks that you run. Stress ulcers, people that are ventilator dependent, people who have a coagulopathy, people who have burns, neurological patients, these are the old Curling's and Cushing's ulcers that we used to talk about all the time. Those folks deserve stress prophylaxis. Some, I'm not going to go through each one of these, but these are oddball, unusual reasons why people have upper GI bleeding. I'd go through this list a time or two before you take the test, because some of these things may well show up. Here's some more causes of upper GI bleeding. You see duodenal and gastric ulcer there at the top. They're the most common, but you've got these rare ones here that you'll see from time to time also. These are details of the rare causes that you'll see causing upper GI bleeding. ZE syndrome, remember, gastric acid hypersecretion, severe peptic ulcer disease, non-beta islet cell tumors of the pancreas. Remember PPP with this particular MEN1, PPP, pituitary pancreas, and what's the third P? Yeah, parathyroid. It's a good acronym or good way to remember that for the examination. Clinical features that distinguish ZE from ZU, just remember everything is exacerbated. If they have a little diarrhea with a duodenal ulcer, they have a lot of diarrhea with ZE. If they lose a little bit of weight because of their peptic ulcer disease, they lose a lot of weight and have steatorrhea with ZE, because there's so much gastric acid being elaborated with ZE that it neutralizes the bicarb. The pH in the small bowel is upset and nutrients aren't digested and absorbed, and so the patient ends up with diarrhea. Remember, with autoimmune metaplastic atrophic gastritis, what the end result can be carcinoid tumors. And what happens is the serum gastrin level goes way up because of the atrophic gastritis. The serum gastrin then operates on the ECF cells. ECF cells then lead, stimulation of the ECF cells leads to the incidence of carcinoid tumors. There's three different types of carcinoid tumors that you want to keep in mind. The characteristics of these are listed here on this particular side, the carcinoids. And remember, there's carcinoids not just in the stomach, but you can have them in the ileum, the appendix, the rectum. You can have them in the respiratory tract. You can have carcinoid tumors just about anywhere in the body. I think in the oncology lecture, I've got a slide on the carcinoid syndrome. We'll go over some of the details about what it causes. But with the metaplastic atrophic gastritis variety that we've been talking about, and I mentioned serum gastrin level goes up, the ECL cells tend to be affected, and percent of gastric carcinoids tends to be about 60 to 80% compared to other places in the GI tract. This first one here, and the second one there, is the one associated with the three Ps. This first one that's associated with the autoimmune metaplastic atrophic gastritis is more malignant than the other types of carcinoid. It can be metastatic, it can be aggressive, difficult to treat, as opposed to the type with MEN1, which it can be malignant as well, but it's not as aggressive a tumor as the one that's associated with metaplastic atrophic gastritis. The sporadic one, which is unfortunately the rarest one, is also the one that's the most indolent and causes the least amount of trouble.